Through music, comedy, interviews, and commentary, we will explore such topics as who actually does the work of the holidays? Hint, it's not the elves. What happened when a Dutch TV crew read violent passages from a Christian Bible disguised as a Quran to people in the street? How Hobby Lobby is trying to teach us hobbyists who no longer have access to birth control how to construct our very own IUDs out of pipe cleaners and glitter. How did the three wise men react to being told it's a girl? And did Jesus have a baby sister? That's Thursday, Christmas Eve, 9 to 10 p.m. Joy of Resistance. Warning, Christian traditionalists might want to tune away or have their complaint forms at the ready.
Have a sister.
Merry Christmas! God rest ye merry gentlemen, let nothing you dismay.
Christmas morning, this Friday from 6 to 8 a.m. here on WBAI, two full-hour radio dramas, a holiday presentation from the Quicksilver Radio Theater. We'll start with Sherlock Holmes and the Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle, and that will be followed by Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, presented by Craig Wickman and the Quicksilver Radio Theater. That's 6 to 8 this Friday morning, Christmas morning, here on WBAI New York. Join us, won't you?
My name, oh, tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy, oh, tidings of comfort and joy.
Comfort and joy indeed. The time is just about 7 p.m., 7:02 if we're being specific. You are listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, and it's time for another exciting edition of Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Only live on for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood.
Good evening to you. The show is Off the Hook here on WBAI New York. And Rob the Firefly here with you. And I'm joined in the studio by Mike. And on the phone by Bernie S.
Greetings from Philadelphia.
And
I can barely hear you, Rob.
Okay, let's see if I can fix that. Joined on the phone also by Emmanuel.
Hello.
And Kyle.
All right. Are you guys having a moment of silence for us?
No, I'm talking, but I don't know. There's some goings on.
Well, we hear you now.
There all right, are. Good. So I was wondering where you guys are, if you're in some exotic, far-off land.
Well, you must know exactly where we are. We're parked outside of McDonald's in Queens. Now, it's not because we went there or anything like that. It's because that's as far as we could get. And it's also where we could park the car. We were trying to get to the station pretty much all day, but it was raining, and when that happens, our roads flood, and people drive even more ridiculously than they usually do. So we decided to cut our losses and just park here at a side street in Queens and do the show from the comfort of a car rather than try and get there and be a half hour late.
Okay, so this might be the first ever edition of Off the Hook broadcast partially from a McDonald's.
Yeah, that could be a first for the show, but it's just, I think, better to not add to the stress out on the roads. And really, it's amazing. There's puddles everywhere, guys, like really big ones. Whole off-ramps are puddles. It's remarkable.
Yeah, we used the Waze navigation system to try and get to the station, and it was telling us about floods, and then it would direct us directly into the flood. So I don't understand what the logic was. And the final straw was when it said, okay, I can get you there quicker, but you have to go into Manhattan, pay a toll in the Midtown Tunnel, then go back to the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel and pay another toll, two tolls to get to Brooklyn from Brooklyn. This made no sense at all. So So that's when we decided just to go to Queens and relax.
I mean, I thank you for supporting the public transit infrastructure, which is what the MTA tolls go for.
I
think you should have done it.
It wasn't our idea. I think Waze is owned by the MTA or something, because it never fails to try and direct you to a toll, even when you don't need to pay one. But that's neither here nor there, because, well, we're here and not there, and we're going to try and do a show on this this holiday period of the year. And we're sorry that we can't be there in person, but you know what? You guys have more space, finally, in that cramped little room.
You're here in spirit and also on speakers.
Nothing says a happy holiday like talking on the phone.
That's true. And Bernie, can you hear us okay?
Yeah, I can hear you guys just great.
You know, a funny thing is that you're the clearest one of them all, as far as people on the station. You're coming through loud and clear, and the other guy is kind of, you know, a little muffled.
I'm working on that. Things have been rearranged since you were here last. So,
really?
Yeah, you could be brushing up right now if you were here, but you're not.
Well, what's the point? It's going to be changed again next week, so I'd have to brush up again. Hey, so we have lots to talk about, and not all of it is happy news. In fact, I'd say probably most of it isn't happy news. We just found out about 12 hours ago when daytime happened in New Zealand, that Kim.com lost his case, or at least initially. He was trying not to get extradited to the United States. It's really amazing. He's never been to the United States, but somehow he's being extradited for running a server in New Zealand and annoying the authorities here. A better way to describe it, perhaps?
I could tell you how much they're accusing him of costing the record industry, as it were. It's about $500 million is the number that's been put on the pirated content his site hosted.
His site being Mega Upload.
It's now Mega, yeah.
It's now Mega.
Although he's personally not involved with Mega these days, he said some time ago that he doesn't trust the people in control of Mega, and he wouldn't use Mega.
Well, you know, that's beside the point, because at this stage, I wouldn't trust the internet or anybody after going through what he went through. What we really should consider, though, is what it was he actually did years ago. And I'm looking into this, and I don't see anything other than running a successful internet service. And, okay, you can say some people used it to pirate material, but there's no indication that he was one of those people in any way.
But are you suggesting that it's that the law of the United States of America shouldn't immediately apply to, say, countries on the other side of the world?
Well, let's try that for a little while, see how that works out. You know, how is it that somebody so far away who's never been to this country and who has really no investments in this country at all can just be dragged over here against his will? I mean, imagine if that were the case with every other country in the world. And we, you know, tonight, somehow, we offend somebody in, oh, I don't know, Botswana. And before you know it, I guess you get a free trip to the country out of this, but you have no say. You wind up getting dragged in front of a court in some foreign land. And the whole thing is just really insane.
What do you have against Botswana?
Well, it was just the first country I thought of at random, so actually they're number one in my eyes.
All right.
It's also worth noting, I think, that when the U.S. Basically coordinated a raid on his mansion in New Zealand back in 2012, took basically all his personal belongings, seized all his assets, both in New Zealand and in other countries where he had bank accounts, he went to court to get his stuff back, and what's called the High Court in New Zealand ruled that the raid was completely illegal, and then the Supreme Court of New Zealand also ruled that this raid was illegal. So you would think that would be the end of the case, but no, the U.S. figures, well, if we can't win under New Zealand law, we'll bring him to the U.S. and we'll prosecute him for under U.S. laws, even though he didn't do anything in the U.S. and has never been in the U.S.
Yeah, I'm looking at a story from stuff.co.nz, and which points out that although the U.S. didn't need to prove the charge at this point, counsel had to at least prove there was an answerable case overseas to fulfill the extradition requirements. The United States also sought to extradite .com's mega co-founders and colleagues Matthias Ortmann and Bram van der Kolk, And all four of them are apparently facing money laundering, racketeering, and breach of copyright charges in the U.S. following allegations that the founders of Mega Upload, formerly a popular file-sharing website, were knowingly allowing copyright material to be shared on a large scale.
Why is it the United States is the only country that would have that kind of interest? Are they suggesting that he could be tried in every country in the world because of similar concerns?
Maybe it's just that we were the first to go and grab him, so now all the other countries are out of luck because we've got him and we can start punishing him. Who knows?
Well, what Kim.com said after the ruling was, this is not the last word on the matter. We have filed an appeal. We're just disappointed. That's all I have to say. I wish everybody a very Merry Christmas. I'm going home now. And hopefully he gets to stay home. He lost his mansion, but, you know, losing the ability to live where you want to live is something far worse. And it's going to be interesting. I imagine they would probably bring him to New York if they did extradite him. And I can only say that the hacker community, I think, will turn out in droves to show their support and their disgust at this particular turn of events.
Yeah, definitely. During court hearings, Mega was said to be one of the most successful internet service providers in history, with more than 1 billion unique visitors in its lifetime.
Yeah, it was essentially a cloud storage service that encrypted the traffic for users.
I mean, I don't believe anything this guy says, though. I mean, like that doesn't make him worthy of what's happening to him. But also, like, I don't believe anything he says.
Why?
Because he's busy comparing himself to, like, people like Snowden and Assange, who have done a lot more than make themselves wealthy. Like, he just seems untrustworthy, which, again, is not reason enough to prosecute him. But, anything he says, I want, like, independent verification for.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have a reason. I mean, is it because the guy's name is .com, because he changed it, because he made a lot of money, because he ran a site that other people use for nefarious purposes? I think you have to have a reason to say you just automatically don't trust the guy.
Yeah, generally probable cause has to be more than the guy's a jerk.
Yeah, I agree that he, you know, I have not seen evidence sufficient to make me think he should be in jail, but I also have seen evidence sufficient to make me not think that, like, I should believe him when he says he's the biggest, most popular man in the world. And, like, yes, his last name is part of it, which he chose. It's not like a family last name that I'm making fun of.
He said he's the biggest, most popular man in the world?
No, his website. He said his website is the biggest, most popular, this, that, and the other. Rob just read it on the air.
Okay.
Some statistics indicated that there was about a billion visitors.
His statistics.
To the service. Okay, he said that. That's true.
I don't know.
Well, we'll definitely be keeping an eye on this as it continues to develop.
Yeah. Again, the appeal has been filed, so it's not the last word. But just think for a second about the hell you have to go through just to battle this in the first place. It's been going on since 2012. That's 3 years of just fighting to not be dragged out of your country and taken to a strange foreign land to face God knows what kind of punishment.
Oh, and one thing, he wants to bring U.S. experts. He wants to bring expert witnesses from the U.S. who are familiar with U.S. law and U.S. copyright law, but the U.S. won't release any of the funds that they've frozen in his bank accounts in order to pay the expert witnesses to testify. So it kind of leaves him in a tough situation.
Well, you know what? I think we can find some expert witnesses that will do it gratis, because this is an important case. And I think the call will go out for people to volunteer their time. And, you know, when he's victorious in the future, I'm sure he'll be generous.
Absolutely.
All right, guys, what's this about Juniper? I'm hearing that there's this back door in Juniper routers now that conveniently is happening right when we're talking about how having back doors for encryption purposes and protecting us against terrorists, how that's a really, really bad idea. And all of a sudden, this story comes along where Juniper is backdoored, And people realize that, you know, when you do that, it's not just the good guy to get access. You have any more information on this?
I mean, information is still filtering in, but Juniper is a large company that makes
networking equipment that really powers a lot of the internet and a lot of corporate networks as well. And they were having an audit of their code, and they discovered that somehow, somewhere in their code was a backdoor, were actually two backdoors, one that would allow people to log into their products with this secret password that was not the password set by the owners of the equipment, and another one that would make it easier to spy upon encrypted traffic as it went over the internet. So if you were connecting to your corporate network and you were encrypting your connection with a VPN so that, you know, your private corporate data couldn't be read by anyone else, well, someone could read that data. And what's unclear at this juncture is who that someone was. There's some evidence to suggest that it's the, you know, the Five Eyes folks, the UK and the US government spying, the NSA, GCHQ. It's not 100% certain yet. If Juniper knows, they're not saying. They may not know. But it's really worrying that this kind of stuff was just inserted into these products without even the knowledge of the company that does it, or they claim without their knowledge. They've released patches, so I guess if you are using Juniper equipment, you should be sure to upgrade. But, you know, it's who would do such a thing and why is a question that a lot of people want the answer to.
Yeah, and one of the reasons they were investigated by the FBI, I believe, is because Juniper itself is, as you said, a manufacturer of switching equipment that supports major ISPs and infrastructure of the Internet, as well as businesses, but also government. So the government's own networks were using some of these platforms, and thus, when Juniper announced this, I think sent a bit of a shockwave through all institutions that would use this kind of hardware, really, because anyone could have been susceptible, and anyone could use this in theory.
You know, also, there was an amazing article that came out today on The Intercept, and it quotes a document, a top-secret document, dated February 2011. And guess who revealed that top-secret document? None other than Edward Snowden. So it's great that we can use these documents that Edward Snowden has liberated as evidence of things that are going on that might not support what governments tell us. But I'll just read this brief excerpt. The six-page document titled Assessment of Intelligence Opportunity, Juniper, raises questions about whether the intelligence agencies were responsible for or culpable in the creation of security holes disclosed by Juniper last week. While it does not establish a certain link between GCHQ, NSA, and the Juniper hacks, it does make clear that, like the unidentified parties behind those hacks, the agencies found ways to penetrate the NetScreen line of security products, which help companies create online firewalls and virtual private networks, or VPNs. And it further indicates that, also like the hackers, GCHQ's capabilities clustered around an operating system called ScreenOS, which powers only a subset of products sold by Juniper, including the NetScreen line, and Juniper's other products, which include high-volume internet routers, run a different operating system called Junos. This whole thing is really fascinating, and I think it's going to be very difficult to argue for backdoors in the future. All right, what do you guys think?
I think it will be exactly as difficult as it is now, which means that politicians who are either willfully or unwillfully not in possession of the facts will continue to make those arguments, and they'll continue to be nonsense arguments, but, you know, that never stopped anyone.
Okay, but you're talking about politicians. How about the average person who thinks that that might keep them safe from terrorists? Seeing this story this week might convince them otherwise.
I am not in touch with what the average person thinks, if there's one thing I've learned over the years.
Okay, well, how about the sub-average person?
Look, I mean, I think it's clear, I think it's been clear for a long time, that backdoors like this, there's no way to make backdoors like this in a way that net enhances security. And that, you know, there's lots of non-terrorist uses for encryption. Like I said, if you have a company and you don't want your competitors reading your business plans, you want encryption. If you have ever bought anything online and you don't want nefarious actors reading your credit card number. You want encryption, and you want this encryption to work, and you don't want it to be vulnerable to backdoors like the ones that were found in the Juniper stuff, because we don't know who had access to this backdoor. Maybe we'll find out in this specific case, but maybe we'll find out who put it there even, but we might never know if someone else found the backdoor before Juniper did, and so there was even an extra unintended reader of all these communications. We'll never know, and that's why this stuff doesn't work, and that's what security experts have been saying for a while. Now they have another piece of evidence to bolster their case, but for the entities that just don't want evidence and just want to compromise all of our security in order to advance their own, you know, agendas, they're ignoring all the existing evidence. I don't know what I think one more piece is going to do.
Mike, did you actually use the phrase nefarious actors just now?
I did, yeah.
Nicely
wow.
used. Nicely
I'm done. Floored.
Would you prefer a different phrase?
No, that's fine. Bernie, I'm curious what your perspective on all this is.
Well, I've been reading a little bit about this, and I think that this could have been a state actor, you know, a government put this in, or and some people are saying it probably wasn't like NSA, because the way they did it, they just put the password in plain text right in the code, right in the code. So that's typically not what they do. But who knows? It could have been a private actor as well. It could have been a disgruntled employee who slipped in this back door and then decided they could sell it for a lot of money to interested parties.
These are not conflicting theories, by the way. It could be a disgruntled employee in the payroll of a state. It could be anything.
Sure. I'm sure there'll be investigations, and there'll probably be cover stories and distractions. We may never know why this really happened. We may hear stories that may or may not be true. But the bottom line is, you really can't. What of this stuff can you trust? I mean, governments trusted Juniper Networks routers and Screen OS and VPNs. So, mm-hmm. What is even trustworthy anymore?
Yeah, the trouble with looking at it as a very incompetently implemented backdoor and saying, well, it can't be the government. I think we've all experienced the government doing things in stupid ways in the past. But also, this is what happens when you, like with backdoors in general, when you have access that you do not control, can then happen.
I mean, I don't want to overstate, you know, the incompetency of this backdoor. It was apparently quite competently done in that it was snuck in there for a period of years.
Right.
And Juniper is, I assume, the kind of company that probably has done other code audits in this time period and missed this. Like, so there was some degree of competence here. Whether that points to a state actor or not, I don't know. But
well, I just hope that we can use this as further ammunition in the case against having backdoors run by any kind of authority. It's always a bad idea. It always backfires. Wrong people get access, and we need to remember that.
Yeah, it's a great example of that.
I hope your optimism is well-placed, Emmanuel. I really do.
Well, regardless of whether or not it works, it is something that proves the point. So I think we should not neglect that fact that here's another example, and this is something that made the media, so maybe people will remember it. But other things that have been talked about in the mass media in the last week is, of course, the presidential campaign. And what happened between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton involving that database? I found this to be really a fascinating story. Now, apparently what happened was there was some kind of a data glitch in this database that both the Clinton campaign and the Sanders campaign had access to, and the Sanders workers were able to see information from the Clinton campaign that they weren't supposed to see. I think there were a total of about 25 searches that were conducted. Now, honestly, you know, if this was really a big deal, I think there'd be a lot more than 25 searches for data that could prove valuable. But my real question here, maybe somebody has a better understanding of this than I do, why in God's name do both campaigns have access to the same database and why are they able to use this on the same machine when there's a problem like this? It should not be something that could be compromised. In other words, what I'm trying to say is the data should exist in their possession, in their offices, or on servers that they control, not a server that a third party controls that shares it with different campaigns. Because things like this are bound to happen and probably not be detected too. I'm sure they have happened in the past. Can you imagine if the Republicans do it this way, how many different campaigns are looking at other campaigns? I don't understand what the system is, what kind of information it holds, and why it's necessary to have it configured in this manner. Does anybody have any insight on that?
Going by what they were saying during the campaign, during the most recent debate, which I was watching for my sins, apparently it was a server that was controlled by the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. So, like, they're both using different parts of the Democratic Party's own machine to run their various campaigns off of, which is strange. Why would they be doing this when they're competing campaigns? But
well, I mean, the short answer is that this data is expensive to collect. It's not just the private data; it's the voter rolls and the voting history, and I don't know what else. But this kind of data, that there's a company that it's their business to aggregate all this data and sell it to campaigns. By the way, like, dear listeners, your data is in this database. Surprise. But and so, you know, when you start a political campaign, you don't want to presumably go and collect all this data yourself, because that would be expensive, and there's a company that can sell it to you for less. It sounds like this company is a little bit incompetent at their security practices, and that to me is more of the story than that the access took place. But it's unsurprising to me that that they rely on a third party to at least collect this data and update it, and then they can make their own notes on it. That, and you know, the competing campaigns obviously should not be able to see each other's notes.
Well, are we talking about voter records that are open to the public? Is this the data that they were buying?
I don't think they've quite made it public what the data actually was.
Yes, it actually it did include that data, but included a lot of other data that each campaign created with the public voter roll data. Like, who is the bottom line is what this data comes down to is registered voters who are registered Democrats, who are most likely to vote for this candidate, that candidate, maybe on particular issues, that sort of thing. So the master data list is available to all the DNC presidential candidates, ostensibly. But then each campaign has their own customized overlay of this data with information that they have created or ferreted out and laid over that. But one interesting thing about this is this company, this vendor, that put out this faulty product that allowed not only Bernie Sanders' campaign to see Hillary Clinton's data, but vice versa. Everybody was seeing everybody's data, according to some reports, at least for a limited period of time. The company is called NGP Van, and the NGP part stands for a guy named Nathan Perlman, who was Hillary Clinton's chief technology officer in her 2008 campaign. So you could have conspiracy theories about this, but
I'd rather not.
And I just think that's an amusing fact that this is a Hillary Clinton guy who sold this product to the Democratic National Committee.
Well, okay, what I don't understand then, and I don't think anybody can explain this to me. Okay, fine, you buy this data from this company. Why in God's name would you store your data on the same system as your competitor? If this service was worth anything, obviously that data would be segregated in a completely different place that was not able to simply have some firewall come down and all of a sudden everybody can see everything. I mean, this is security 101 here.
You would think.
I mean, I don't know if what exactly the architecture should be. I don't think I can second guess their architecture without knowing more details about it, but it's clear from the effects that they have done something terribly wrong, and they should be in a lot more trouble, I think, than this one Bernie Sanders former employee.
You want to know about the architecture, Mike? Okay, ask any sixth grade kid who has a computer that he shares with his family, and the data that he wants to keep secret from the rest of the family is probably more secure than the way this was done here.
Yeah, and it was certainly, I think, the way they were using the data that was the concern from either side of the campaign. It's sort of along the lines of what Bernie was saying previously. So it's my read that, in that light, that why not, you know, if you're going to look at this system, even if it's set up for you to use and evaluate the data for your campaign, you might maybe, with the insight that it's shared in this way, you might move the analysis to a different machine. Fine, you know, use whatever accounts the committee gives you and glean the data maybe in a sort of a manual way or otherwise export it so you can use it elsewhere and keep that analysis safe. That would have been sort of logical to me, but maybe it was a revelation that they were co-located in the first place and thus the story.
I mean, there's plenty of businesses that keep multiple companies' data on the same machine and don't make this kind of error. So, like, every business, basically, that provides any internet service ever is able to keep multiple companies' data on the same machine without letting one company see the other company's data.
Yeah, so, Mike, do you think Coke and Pepsi would be on the same machine?
If they both use Google, then yeah, sure.
No, I think Pepsi uses Yahoo and Coke uses Bing.
Maybe, Kyle.
Anyway,
the Bernie Sanders campaign, well, at least the Bernie Sanders spokesman Michael Briggs said that four Sanders campaign staffers accessed the Hillary Clinton data on this database, and three of them did so at the direction of their boss, a guy named Josh Uretsky, who happens to live a mile from me here in Philadelphia. And Josh Uretsky was the guy who was fired. Josh Uretsky told CNN on Friday morning, this is according to the Washington Post, that he and others on the campaign discovered the software glitch on Wednesday morning, and they probed the system to discover the extent of the Bernie Sanders data exposure. He said there was no attempt to take Clinton's information, but he said he took responsibility for what happened. So I don't think he should have taken responsibility for what happened. I think the Democratic National Committee should take responsibility for what happened in using this flawed product.
Bernie, just one question. How do you know he lives a mile away from you?
I've read this, and I met the guy at a campaign event several years ago. So he lives in Fishtown, which is just like a mile from me.
I mean, you can also find out, Bernie, where he lives if you request from the Secretary of State of Pennsylvania, where you both apparently live, the voter registration rules, and then you can get his address and just plot it on a map.
There you go.
Yeah, I agree with what you just said, Bernie. I think at worst he was doing due diligence for the campaign to try to figure out what the heck's going on.
So isn't this what hackers frequently get blamed for? Aren't hackers frequently blamed as the messenger? They're blamed, you know, the messenger is being blamed as opposed to pointing out, like, hey, there's a problem here. I'm going to document the problem. And he was documenting it. And he wasn't keeping it to himself. He was telling other folks, like, this is what's going on. And then he get fired. So I don't think Bernie Sanders himself really understood this thing because he apologized to Hillary Clinton at that debate. And I don't think he should have apologized, frankly.
Well, I think he just saw something that was going to get in the way and had to be dealt with in a mature manner, and he did the quickest thing he could think of to expedite that. But, yeah, I agree. I don't think, based on previous knowledge of how these things play out, that there was actually any kind of crime or even breaking of the rules. I don't know if that happened. I don't see evidence to suggest anything more than, wait a second, do we really have access to this? Let's do a search and find out. And 25 searches might sound like a lot to some people, but it really is not very much at all.
Yeah, I mean, there's really no way to know because the political campaigns want this story to go away as quickly as possible. They certainly don't want us talking about, you know, the fact that this one vendor has all this data about everyone. You know, for a very long time. They don't want us to keep talking about it. So we'll probably never know exactly what this guy did and if his firing was justified or not.
Well, one thing I do want to know, and I hope somebody listening can tell us, What system do the Republicans use? Do they use something as boneheaded as this, where they're all on the same machine, or do they use their own private systems everywhere? Is it accessible in the same way? Do they have the same mistakes being made? I would like to know more.
Well, they're probably, unfortunately, not using the Democratic National Committee's machine.
Well, that would be funny if they were. That would be about as absurd, wouldn't it?
I mean, there's definitely vendors in this sort of space that do business with both Democrats and Republicans. Apparently, NGP Van is not one of them, but there are others who do.
Well, now, also, there's this this group known as SOBH Cyber Jihad. I'm sure you've all heard of them. They're an Iranian hacktivist group. They've claimed responsibility for a cyber attack that gave it access to the control system for a dam in the suburbs of New York. And an intrusion that one official said may be just the tip of the iceberg. SOBH Cyber Jihad sent a message through another Iran-linked hacker outfit called Paristu, promising that it would release the technical information that proves it was behind the 2013 breach. The hackers claim they kept quiet about the attack for 2 years because of a state-level warning not to go public with it for the greater good. And it wasn't until the Wall Street Journal reported the breach this past weekend that the SOBH Cyber Jihad said it decided to take credit for the operation against. And here it is, folks, write this down. The Bowman Avenue Dam in Rybrook, New York, which is just north of New York City. Apparently that dam has been compromised by Iranians. Now, my question, and I've asked this question so many times, is why in God's name is a dam on the Internet? I mean, is there any reason in the world for that to be the case?
Maybe this has something to do with why you're flooded out and you couldn't come to the show today.
I mean, so what is, I mean, I guess I know your proposal is just run dams the way they did 100 years ago, but, like, there's value in people being, authorized people being able to see the status of dams and control them without, you know, physically driving to them.
Wait, you're saying that there aren't any people at this dam? Basically, it's controlled remotely?
I don't know how this dam operates. I don't know a damn thing about it. But there's value in being able to see, you know, even if there's operators at the dam, there's value in being able to see things on a sort of network-wide level, see all the dams and make decisions that way. It seems fairly obvious to me that there's value there. Why this thing is implemented in such a way that, you know, unauthorized parties can get to it, that I don't know.
Well, I don't know why you can't have a damn network that is basically closed to the outside world, and just people can be on the damn network and talk amongst themselves without the whole world being able to have access to it.
Because this is the year 2015, and we're building the Internet of Damn Things.
Seems that way.
There are some damning holes in their security, it's true, yeah.
Yeah, this is something that, you know, again, Security 101, you don't have critical infrastructure available and accessible through these kinds of online methods. If you need that convenience, just understand there's a risk in, attached to that convenience, and you need to be damn sure, no pun intended, I really meant it that time, that you've looked at all the risks, and you're confident that there aren't security holes like this. Because this is the problem is not a bunch of hackers anywhere. The problem is people that don't think these things through, and they're in charge of critical infrastructure. They're making major decisions, and they're making really bad decisions.
I think also it has a lot to do with the way they implement the machines and the systems in these kinds of environments. A lot of times they'll get equipment that uses off-the-shelf operating systems, and then you get employees and workers who are maybe co-located. They're in the facility, and the process machines are right there at their fingertips for certain amounts of information, and they end up using it for other things. I had an experience like this working in a production environment where a process control machine was also being used to surf the Internet because it was right there, and, well, everything with the process was fine, but operators would sit around and browse the web. As soon as our manager found out, it was like it was everybody's concern. No one was allowed to do anything, and it became a big deal. But I think that's one of the hazards because the culture as well as the types of tools that are in these industrial environments, both of those, I think, are weak points that create these kind of situations.
It's really not hard to run a database and not have it attached to the entire Internet. I know we've been doing this now for 30 years, and there's just no reason to have something accessible, and you can do all the things you need to do using slightly different habits to access people's accounts or whatnot. But you have to be aware of individual security and security of your company or operation as a whole. And I think what we see week after week, what we report on this show constantly, are examples of that not happening and people just not learning.
So, Emmanuel, I think I disagree with you. I don't think this proves that the Security 101 has failed. I think it's proved that Security 101 is insufficient. This stuff is really hard, apparently for everyone in the world except you. To make secure systems is hard, which goes back to the previous point of why we should not be spending our time, you know, explicitly making them weaker. I think we can all agree that's a bad idea. But getting this right is hard, and...
It's not hard.
Yeah, it is, Emmanuel.
Well, it might be hard for you. It's not hard for people that know what they're doing. Sorry. It's not hard to keep data secure if you know what you're doing. That is a fact.
I know plenty of people who spend their lives working on this stuff because it's hard.
Okay. Well,
I mean, maybe they're all dumb. I'm certainly willing to concede that I might be dumb, and maybe everyone I know is dumb. I don't know. But if that's the bar, then we need some really, really smart people.
I'm sorry, Emmanuel. Just because this group, SOBA Cyber Jihad, claims to be a group of Iranians, that doesn't mean this has anything to do with a state action. This doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the Iranian government. I'm guessing it probably doesn't, any more than American hackers are acting on behalf of the U.S. government. Just because somebody's nationality may or may not be Iranian doesn't mean it's the Iranian government that has attacked this this dam control system. And it's not even a major dam. If someone was going to really cause havoc, this is like one of the weakest. This is one of the least important targets that would be chosen. But if anything, maybe this will be good that this was caught, discovered, and then maybe the dam control systems in the rest of the country will get better security. Damn it!
Yeah, I think this is sort of the overlapping of technological solutions. The people in the facility are probably really still excited that they have computer controls now. I mean, that alone was probably an upgrade for that type of industrial system. The point is, I think, that as these systems mature, as they become more connected, we need to be ever more conscious of the pitfalls of technological solutions and maybe step away. And I think to Eve's point, really look for the simple, logical stuff instead of throwing tons of more technology at it, because that begets more pitfalls, generally speaking.
And let's say, put the Kool-Aid aside for a second, because the newest technology is not always the best technology. Sometimes, the way we did it 100 years ago might have worked better. We have to look at these things and say, what do we actually need for this to be able to do? And is it working now? Do we need to, quote-unquote, upgrade something or change it? Lots of times, I don't know about you guys, but when I get an update to software or something else that I don't have a say in, it's worse than it was before. And, the latest gizmos, the latest access, tying it all together, sometimes it's not the best thing to do, and we need to be able to have a constant conversation about that.
Well, on that note, it might be trickier with both of you guys on the phone, but do you want to try and take some phone calls?
I just wanted to mention one more story, and then, I'm all for it. But apparently, the state senate here in... this is the state senate in Massachusetts. That's another problem with all these stories that people send us, is that they don't say what state they're talking about. It's from the Boston Globe, so I'm making the assumption it's about the Massachusetts state senate. They've decided that your boss is not necessarily your friend, as in Facebook friend. The 2015 legislative session recently ended without much fanfare, but among the few bills moving forward was a Senate proposal that would prohibit employers from asking job applicants and employees to hand over passwords for personal social media accounts or from requesting to be friended. And that law would also make it illegal for schools to make the same demands of students. You know, this kind of thing, it's another example of people accepting things they don't have to accept. But I'm blown away by this. People actually are asked, and they comply. They give their passwords out to their prospective bosses or schools. How is that a thing that is even remotely accessible?
I mean, so I think this is a good bill. I think we agree that bosses should not be in the business of demanding their employees' social media passwords. And I think that a law is the thing that will stop it, because a lot of people, when they apply for a job, you know, if depending on the types of jobs they're applying for, they may not feel that they have the negotiating power to say no. They may need a job immediately, and they're willing to trade their social media password for that job. If there's another applicant who will provide it and you won't, you know, you might not get the job. So what this does is it levels the playing field. It allows everyone to say no, and I think we should have bills like this all over the place.
But, you know, why do we need a bill? It should just be illegal to ask somebody to give up their security, password.
Where do you think laws come from, Emmanuel? Yes, it should be illegal. It's not currently illegal. How do we fix that? We pass a law.
It just seems like something that's already not legal under some other law. But fine, you know, if a law will keep people from asking for this, then I guess that's what we need. But it just seems ridiculously...
I don't know about not legal, but with many social media services, it is against their terms of service for you to share your passwords with someone else. So you would be breaking the rules of Facebook or whatever other site if you gave your password to that service to a prospective employer.
I'd like to hear from our listeners, oth@2600.com. Have you ever been asked for one of your passwords by a superior, whether it be a boss or a headmaster at a school or something like that? Let us know how you dealt with it, how they dealt with it. oth@2600.com. I would ask the people here, but I'm pretty sure that none of us ever gave out passwords just because somebody asked for it. Never.
I mean, no, I haven't, but, you know, not everyone's in the position that I'm in, so.
What, the position of having privacy, having their own choice in the matter?
The position of being able to turn down jobs that I don't want.
That's rarer by the day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, enough. Go ahead, Rob.
Okay. Well, I just want to say we do want to try and take some phone calls. We'll see if we can make this work. 718-780-8888 is the number to call us on the air. So give that a try, and we will try and get you on.
We just have a few minutes left, so if you want to talk to us, you should call now. It's true.
So you were saying, Kyle.
Oh, no, I was just saying they're probably not the type of jobs that demand that kind of scrutiny. But I kind of hear where he's going. I think that there's some kind of validation there in that kind of scrutiny, which sounds really weird because it's counterintuitive. The law is supporting privacy. But I think there is some weird sense that we're accepting some situations where an employer might have to have access or that kind of access. It's akin to a background check. I really don't feel like a job interview should be like a background check. It should be different. Right. I don't know. I feel like they then appear to have more authority than they do at all.
All right, let's take some listener phone calls, see what they think. Good evening, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi there. Let me turn the radio off. I got three very quick things. I am a systems-level programmer. The business about these back doors that were mentioned, and this is, I've seen this happen in many places that I've worked at and also do code audits, these usually get put in by somebody who's working on the project, usually when they're doing development or for maintenance. Sometimes they just get forgotten to be taken out. And the business of when stuff is in clear code, that's so you can put a sniffer in there and you can run all kinds of tests. And it's extremely common. Happens all the time. Okay, second thing, It sounds like you guys, and I assume you're not systems programmers, because it sounds like you're not familiar with system management mode. So I would like you all to go to Wikipedia and look up system management mode.
Okay.
This is a whole operating level below systems level on x86s. It's the way that Stuxnet got violated and all the others. And if you follow the external links at the bottom of the Wikipedia page, I think things will be a lot clearer. And the third thing is there was recently an extremely good book on Internet security written by a fellow named Steve Bellavin. He was at Bell Labs for many years, and he retired, and he's now a professor at Columbia University. If you go to Amazon and you search his name, Steve Bellavin, B-E-L-L-O-V-I-N, I don't know if I can give the press. It's an Addison Wesley book, and it is truly excellent. It's it really explains what you got to do to protect systems. Thanks, guys. Oh, and Eric, have a good holiday. Bye-bye.
You too. Thanks. Yeah, I mean, I think it goes to the point that this stuff is hard.
It is, and that's why people make their livings working on it. But the people who can understand the hard stuff, it should be sort of standard procedure to take care of things like this before they get to the end user.
The other question to ask is it necessary? You know, yeah, it's hard to do certain things. It's hard to go to Mars right now, and that's why we're not doing it. When we get it right, you know, that's like nuclear power, for instance. That's really hard to do. We're not at a stage yet where it works. So maybe one day we will be, and then it's a good idea to do it, but not now. You know, things like that.
Indeed. Okay, we've got time for maybe a couple of more phone calls. 718-780-8888. No one on the line yet.
Call now.
I think we might be limited to one slot since we've got both Emmanuel and Bernie on the line.
We also learned that phone calls transfer themselves all over the station.
All right, I'm going to interrupt you because there's some blinking ones now.
Yeah, grab it fast.
Good evening. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
How do you do?
The Iranians were breaking into the what was it, the waterfalls?
A dam, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, did you tell Donald Trump about this? He's going to make America great again. I mean, my God.
Well, here's a thought.
We'll get right on that. Thank you.
You can jump right on that.
thank you very much.
Jump right into the dam, too.
Yeah, I don't have Donald Trump's phone number, alas. If I did, there's so many things I would want to tell him.
Why do you think that is, Mike? It's because he knows how to keep it secure. You see?
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's in the phone book. I haven't even checked. But we have another caller. You're on the air. Hello.
I'm calling about the elections at WBAI. Have you guys got any recommendations for that, or are you not allowed to do that over the air?
Wait, which elections are we talking about?
The station board elections.
See, I thought you were talking about the national elections in another year.
These are more immediate. They're coming up the deadline of January 4th to put in our ballots. And after trying to make donations, it got bounced and not getting the access codes to vote in it. I finally got the ability to do it, apparently, and I'm wondering, it appears to me there's somebody trying to destroy the station who's on the board already, and somebody seems to be not trying to destroy the station. I wonder if you have any insights to that.
Well, we're not going to use the show as a platform to endorse or not endorse, but my only advice is vote, and you can make an informed decision by doing a little research, reading some websites, searching in Google. You'll find what you're looking for, I think.
Okay, I just had the impression that the peace and justice people were sort of saboteurs.
No comment.
But thank you very much for your interest and taking part in things here. Let's see, have we got another caller?
We have not. If you're calling us and it's still ringing, it's ringing somewhere else other than the board.
We're seeing some ringing on the other phone here, where things have been getting bounced. So if you're on for more than a few rings and it doesn't seem to be picking up, try calling back again. Right now, 718-780-8888. We can maybe get you in at the very last minute.
Let's try this caller. Hello.
Hello. Hi. Let me turn my radio down.
Please.
And, this is the computer show.
This is off the hook.
The personal computer show is on after us.
There was an an appropriations bill that just passed to cover the government's expenses for another month.
Yeah.
And in it, they stuck a bill that had failed in Congress because of public outcry, and it was to prevent people from suing their internet provider for the internet provider giving information about you to the federal government.
Yeah, this is the CISA bill. It's terrible. I wish we had more time to talk about it, but we haven't.
Okay, at least you know about it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I wish we could have done something to stop it, but as you say, it got snuck into the appropriations bill at sort of the last minute.
And the forces of darkness move quickly.
It's only controversial to people, you know, who have interest in these issues, not to Congress people, so.
Yes, indeed. Well, on that note, we are about to wrap things up for the year 2015. Thank you very much for joining us.
It's not true.
It's not true yet, but we're about to.
We're on next week, Rob.
We're on next week, okay. And it's still 2015 next week. Are you guys sure?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, to get us some info before the end of the year, send us email at oth@2600.com. Be sure to stay tuned for the Personal Computer Show. For Off the Hook, this is Rob T. Firefly. Have a very good night.
Bye.
piss everybody off. Merry Christmas. And what do we have here? Hey! Wow, it's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, December 23rd, 2015. You know what that means, Hank? Yeah, I know what you know what it means. It means it's time for the personal computer shoe. And we're going to start it right now. What do you say?
Hello, world. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key in the studio of WBAI with Stevie DB, who just made those pre-announcements, and we have Joe King on remote. We're planning to get other members of the show for the end of the year, and that's David Perry, Dr. Alfred Poor, and Michael Horowitz to end out the year, and we're going to talk about what happened in the year 2015 and what might we expect in 2016. The Personal Computer Show is presented live each week and is streamed on the internet via WBAI.org, that's .org, and we will be live next week with regular programming December the 30th, same time as today, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And a little later, we'll be taking telephone calls, and the on-air number, you'll write it down now, 718-780-8888. Let me just repeat that. We're going to be taking phone calls at 718-780-8888. Now, we're going to do something a little different, and Joe will join me in on this. WBA had a mini fundraiser the past 2 weeks, and those who donated to BAI, we thank you for your pledge, and we hope you make good on it. And we're back on regular programming now, but for listeners who may want to make a holiday gift to the station, we have still the BAI Buddy. Now, for those who have made a pledge crediting the Personal Computer Show for a BAI Buddy starting with last week, December 16th, we will personally thank you. Just send us a copy of a confirmation for a BAI Buddy between December 16th through January 31st. In other words, it's a window of 6 weeks. And we will send you your preference for one of the following full installation Windows 10, the latest copy, build 1511 DVD, which was released last month in the middle of November, for upgrade or new installation replacement for Windows 7 or 8.1. So if you, in addition to everything you get with the BAI Buddy, we will personally add to it one of four that you will choose, Windows 10 Home 32 bits, Windows 10 Home 64 bits, or Windows 10 Pro 32 bits, or Windows 10 Pro 64 bits. Now, how do you determine which operating system you have currently installed? You go to Control Panel, Start Control Panel, go to System, it's in alphabetic sequence, and the current Windows operating system is displayed. Our website is pcradioshow.org, and once you've joined, you will receive a BAI Buddy card and tote bag, and the card will allow you to have many member benefits. But on the confirmation, just send us an email with a copy of the confirmation and whatever information you have.
Well, Hank, you haven't told them how they could become a BAI Buddy.
I was just going to say, Joe, can you now tell them?
No.
Well, you go to WBAI.org, and I think in the upper right-hand corner there is a spot there for to be a BAI Buddy. Okay? And Joe, you can check up on that since you have the machine in front of you. And
unfortunately, well, maybe I can.
Well, you got a smartphone, right? That we're not calling you on your smartphone because it's not that smart to be able to, yet you can use it. You have to use a regular landline.
Let's see.
Okay, now, Joe, let me get started, okay? One of the things that I just found out is that at midnight or 1 minute after midnight tonight, Eastern, or actually, it's really in each time zone, they'll start at a different time. Spotify said that the Beatles catalog will be available on Spotify for all users, both free and premium. And they will be streaming 13 remastered studio albums as well as four essential collection of the Beatles performances. That's going to go on for at least more than a day, right, Joe?
Yep.
And now, I was talking to someone about it, Joe, and I got some grandchildren that were born after the 60s. Their question was, who are the Beatles?
Actually, Hank, I would like to point out for historical purposes that the Beatles, who I think that very first album was in 63. I'm not positive of that.
Yeah, and then they went on the Ed Sullivan Show, and they really got then just...
But from the time they went on the Ed Sullivan Show till today, they were the and are the biggest selling group ever in the history of recorded music.
Yeah. Of course, with Joe, you remember Rudy Valley, so you really predate all this.
Who was that, Hank?
Rudy Valley, I said.
Oh, he's one of those guys from your day and age. we don't pay attention to them, those of us who are millennials.
Hey, you know, we do have some important news item, and one that really stuck in my mind, and I went over this with you, Joe, is that LifeLock, you know, you hear a lot of ads about LifeLock, how they can, prevent identity theft and so on.
They're not doing too good, are they?
Nope. They got hit with a nine-figure penalty with the FTC because there were complaints. And this is a second charge, and...
they didn't get into trouble because there were complaints. They got into trouble because they were liars.
Well, but because it came from the complaints, people were complaining that that they were not getting protected at all. And one of the things I do want to say is that they got hit with over $100 million fine, but of that $100 million... $68 million.
How much money had they collected over the last few years if they could get hit with a fine like that?
Well, you know what? At least for those who are not happy, at least they may get pennies on the dollar. I don't know, but $68 million has been earmarked for class action refunds, with a stipulation that the payout of that $68 million cannot go for anything for attorney fees.
I hear you, Hank. I hear you, but I'm not sure about that.
Well, the thing is, the judge also says you only have 120 days from, I guess, yesterday to file for a refund. One of the things that LifeLock always been advertising, and I know that some of the talk show hosts on radio, you know, they constantly advertise with LifeLock, is that the CEO, has his social security number on a truck, and it's painted, and goes around New York City, and he talks about, see, he's not afraid to, you know, tell everyone what his social security number. The truth was, he's been hacked a number of times. Right. Now, CISA, C-I-S-A, and you asked me, Joe, what does CISA stand for? I looked it up. It stands for Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act. And why don't you tell the audience why you're upset about this?
Well... If you remember the Uniting and Strengthening America Act, some people call it the Patriot Act.
You mean it had nothing to do with patriotism?
No, it had to do with uniting and strengthening America in their war against whatever. That act had some regulations on what data could be acquired by the NSA and other governmental agencies. And finally, after several court battles and various judges ruling in various ways, it was determined that in order for them to collect information and use that information, it had to be related to national security. Okay, not too many of us really understood what that was all about. Now that along comes this CISA Act.
That was passed as part of the funding of the government. It got slipped.
Yeah, it was on the bottom paragraph of page 9,043,000.
Yeah.
And what this act did, and it'll probably be overturned if it ever gets to the Supreme Court, and if that's before the Supreme Court gets changed to be even more fascist.
Yeah, but the thing is, if it gets to the Supreme Court, the damage has already been done. Like, for instance, it used to be that the information that they provide the government. In other words, we're talking about the phone company, that they would ask information from, or the internet suppliers. That if it had nothing to do with cybersecurity, they're supposed to redact that information before they give it to the government. And now, they don't have to do that anymore with this new act.
If the new act is upheld by the nonsensical Supreme Court,
and I think that what they did was they watered down the what we didn't like to begin with, they made it even worse.
Well, what they did was something that in non-cyber world, in the real world, had been thrown out of court 100 times, and that is, if you had an illegal search and seizure, then you could not use that material that was searched, even for another case or a different case. What they were doing here was they were saying, previously to this, the rewriting of the Uniting and Strengthening America Act was that if you illegally obtained material that was not related to national security, you could not use it, period. You got it accidentally, you couldn't use it. Because so many of the people who were breaking the law and having bad taps, bad hacks, bad what have you, were saying, well, we didn't mean to do it, but as long as we got the information, let's act on it, and sometimes act on it wrongly. Well, they didn't like the fact that they were being told, if you break the law, it works against you. And that's, they bought themselves a couple of congresspeople and passed the law again. Now, I was told, incidentally, Hank, that I really couldn't say that they bought themselves a couple of congresspeople. So let me rephrase that for you.
I like the way you do that, yeah. Joe.
No, let me rephrase it. I was advised that I was really not allowed to say that. So what they did was they gave a couple of $1 million to a couple of congresspeople, and accidentally those congresspeople passed the law that they wanted.
Actually, you're almost right. You know why? I don't think that many of the congresspeople really read the stuff that they vote on.
No, it depends on who buys, who donates money to them.
Because a lot of stuff is just put together that, like, you know, with a few days before, and then they say, sign this. And
no, you're quite wrong.
No?
Quite wrong. No, it's weeks and months before that the lobbyists write the laws. It's not.
Yeah.
They never write them at the last minute.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, you know, what I thought was big news was, what do you think about a company that is shedding their division because... Now, you told me here is a PDF file of Toshiba. They had a press release talking about the fact that they are shedding a lot of divisions. They already sold their semiconductor division to Sony. They're cutting back on they want to find a buyer for their computer division, their appliance division. And after they shed all these divisions, they say they're going to be a stronger company. And they said that they had overstatement of for the past 7 years of profits when there were no profits. And now, the term they didn't use, but I'm going to use, okay, like you, call it what it is. They cooked the books. And
yeah, they did indeed. And the layoff that they just announced...
is huge.
They announced a layoff of 6,800 employees. And then in the next paragraph down, they said, oh, and incidentally, we're also going to lay off 1,000 office workers. They never admitted to laying off 7,800 people, just 6,800 and then 1,000.
And so far...
And so they're still cooking their books.
Yeah, and you know what upsets me is half the management quit, the other half is still there. And you say, hey, it should be the whole management should be replaced.
No, not necessarily, Hank. Yeah. Sometimes you only want to replace the people who are crooks, and if they all quit... you might need the others to keep the company running. No, I'm not that black and white about this.
Well, the thing is that they're going to be shedding the health unit. They're really shedding a whole lot of business. And I know that one of the things we did talk about was that they're targeting for April 1st to shed their computer PC operation, and there'll be three companies are joining. That's Vio, Fujitsu, and Toshiba. And the reason I bring that up is because you may say, well, you know what? At least you could still get some support for it. But if they are shedding these divisions, and where are the spare parts coming from if it's needed?
The problem with companies like this is a large percentage of their output is in portable computing, netbooks, things.